was defeat and victory together before he even knew it himself. Nothing so subtle, so complex, so beautiful had ever been seen on an Azad board. He believed that. He knew that. He would make it the truth. The game went on. Breaks, days, evenings, conversations, meals, they came and went in another dimension. A monochrome thing, a flat, grainy image. He was somewhere else entirely. Another dimension, another image. His skull was a blister with a board inside it, his outside self just another piece to be shuffled here and there. He didn't talk to Nikasar, but they conversed. They carried out the most exquisitely textured exchange of mood and feeling through those pieces which they moved and were moved by. A song, a dance, a perfect poem. People filled the game room every day now, engrossed in the fabulously perplexing work taking shape before them, trying to read that poem, see deeper into this moving picture, listen to this symphony, touch this living sculpture, and so understand it. It goes on until it ends, Görgey thought to himself one day, and at the same time as the banality of the thought struck him, he saw that it was over. The climax had been reached, it was done, destroyed, could be no more. It was not finished, but it was over. A terrible sadness swamped him, took hold of him like a piece, and made him sway and nearly fall, so that he had to walk to his stool seat and pull himself onto it like an old man. Oh, he heard himself say. He looked at Nikasar, but the Emperor hadn't seen it yet. He was looking at element cards, trying to work out a way to alter the terrain ahead of his next advance. Görgey couldn't believe it. The game was over. Couldn't anybody see that? He looked despairingly around the faces of the officials, the spectators, the observers and adjudicators. What was wrong with them all? He looked back at the board, hoping desperately that he might have missed something, made some mistake that meant there was still something Nikasar could do, that the perfect dance might last a little longer. He could see nothing. It was done. He looked at the time shown on the point board. It was nearly time to break for the day. It was a dark evening outside. He tried to remember what day it was. The fire was due very soon, wasn't it? Perhaps tonight or tomorrow. Perhaps it had already been. No, even he would have noticed. The great high windows of the prow hall were still unshuttered, looking out into the darkness where the huge cinder buds waited, heavy with fruit. Over. 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 His. Their. Beautiful game. Over. Dead. What had he done? He put his clenched hands over his mouth. Nikasar, you fool! The Emperor had fallen for it, taken the bait, entered the run and followed it to be torn apart near the high stand, storms of splinters before the fire. Empires had fallen to barbarians before, and no doubt would again. Görgey knew all this from his childhood. Culture children were taught such things. The barbarians invade and are taken over. Not always. Some empires dissolve and cease, but many absorb. Many take the barbarians in and end up conquering them. They make them live like the people they set out to take over. The architecture of the system channels them, beguiles them, seduces and transforms them, demanding from them what they could not before have given, but slowly grow to offer. The empire survives. The barbarians survive. But the empire is no more, and the barbarians are nowhere to be found. The culture had become the empire. The empire, the barbarians. Nikasar looked triumphant. Pieces everywhere, adapting and taking and changing and moving in for the kill. But it would be their own death change. They could not survive as they were. Wasn't that obvious? They would become Görgey's or neutrals. Their rebirth, his to deliver. Over. A prickling sensation began behind his nose and he sat back, overcome by the sadness of the game's ending, and waiting for tears. None came, a suitable reprimand from his body for using the elements so well and water so much. He would drown Nikosar's attacks. The Emperor played with fire and would be extinguished. No tears for him. Something left Görgey, just ebbed away, burned out, relaxing its grip on him. The room was cool, filled with a spirit fragrance, and the rustling sound of the cinderbud canopy outside beyond the tall, wide windows. People talked quietly in the galleries. He looked around and saw Harmin sitting in the college seats. The old Apex looked shrunken and doll-like, a tiny, withered husk of what he'd been, face lined and body misshapen. Gergay stared at him. Was this one of their ghosts? Had he been there all the time? Was he still alive? The unbearably old Apex seemed to be staring fixedly at the centre of the board, and for one absurd instant, Gergay thought the old creature was already dead, and they'd brought his desiccated body into the prow hall as some sort of trophy, a final ignominy. Then the horn sounded for the end of the evening's play, and two Imperial guards came and wheeled the dying Apex away. The shrunken, grizzled head looked briefly in his direction. Gergay felt as though he'd been somewhere far away, on a great journey he'd just returned from. He looked at Nikosar, consulting with a couple of his advisers, as the adjudicators noted the closing positions and the people in the gallery stood up and started chattering. Did he imagine that Nikosar looked concerned, even worried? Perhaps so. He felt suddenly very sorry for the Emperor, for all of them, for everybody. He sighed, and it was like the last breath of some great storm that had passed through him. He stretched his arms and legs, stood again. He looked at the board. Yes. Over. He'd done it. There was much left to do, a lot still to happen, but Nikosar would lose. He could choose how he lost, fall forward and be absorbed, fall back and be taken over, go berserk and raise everything. But his board empire was finished. He met the Emperor's gaze for a moment. He could see from the expression there that Nikosar hadn't fully realized yet, but he knew the Apex was reading him in return and could probably see the change in the man. Sense the sense of victory. Gergay lowered his gaze from that hard sight and turned away and walked out of the hall. There was no acclaim. There were no congratulations. Nobody else could see. Fleer Imsaho was its usual concerned, annoying self, but it too hadn't spotted anything and still inquired how he thought the game was going. He lied. The limiting factor thought things were building up to a head. He didn't bother to tell it. He'd expected more of the ship, though. He ate alone, mind blank. He spent the evening swimming in a pool deep inside the castle, carved out of the rock spur the fortress had been built upon. He was alone. Everybody else had gone to the castle towers and the higher battlements, or had taken to air cars, watching the distant glow in the sky to the west, where the incandescence had begun. Gergay swam until he felt tired, then dried, dressed in trews, shirt and a light jacket, and went for a walk round the castle's curtained wall. The night was dark and recovering of cloud. The great cinder buds, higher than the outer walls, closed off the distant light of the approaching incandescence. Imperial guards were out, ensuring that nobody started the fire early. Gergay had to prove to them he wasn't carrying anything which could produce a spark or flame before they would let him out of the castle, where shutters were being readied and the walkways were damp from tests of the sprinkler systems. The cinder buds creaked and rustled in the windless gloom, exposing new, tinder-dry surfaces to the rich air, bark layers unpeeling from the great bulbs of flammable liquid that hung beneath their topmost branches. The night air was saturated by the heady stench of their sap. A hushed feeling lay over the ancient fortress, a religious mood of awed anticipation, which even Gergay would experience as a tangible change in the place. The swooshings of returning air cars coming in over a damped-down swathe of forest to the castle reminded Gergay that everybody was supposed to be in the castle by midnight, and he went back slowly, drinking in the atmosphere of still expectation like something precious that could not last for long, or perhaps ever be again. Still, he wasn't tired. The pleasant fatigue from his swim had become just a sort of background tingle in his body, and so when he climbed the stairs to the level of his room, he didn't stop, but kept going up, even as the horn sounded to announce midnight. Gergay came out at last onto a high battlement beneath a stubby tower. The circular walkway was damp and dark. He looked to the west, where a dim, fuzzy red glow lit up the edge of the sky. The incandescence was still far away below the horizon, its glare reflecting off the overcast like some livid artificial sunset. Despite that light, Gergay was conscious of the depth and stillness of the night as it settled round the castle, quieting it. He found a door in the tower and climbed to its machicolated summit. He leaned on the stonework and looked out into the north, where the low hills lay. He listened to the dripping of a leaking sprinkler somewhere beneath him and the barely audible rustlings of the cinder buds as they prepared for their own destruction. The hills were quite invisible. He gave up trying to make them out and turned again to that barely curved band of dark red in the west. A horn sounded somewhere in the castle, then another and another. There were other noises too, distant shouting and running footsteps, as though the castle was waking up again. He wondered what was going on. He pulled the thin jacket closed, suddenly feeling the coolness of the night as a light easterly breeze started up. The sadness he'd felt during the day had not fully left him. Rather, it had sunk in, become something less obvious but more integral. How beautiful that game had been! How much he had enjoyed it, exulted in it! But only by trying to bring about its cessation, only by ensuring that that joy would be short-lived. He wondered if Nikosar had realized yet. He must have had a suspicion, at least. He sat down on a small stone bench. Gurge realized suddenly that he would miss Nikosar. He felt closer to the Emperor in some ways than he had ever felt to anybody. That game had been a deep intimacy, a sharing of experience and sensation Gurge doubted any other relationship could match. He sighed, eventually, got up from the bench, and went to the parapet again, looking down to the paved walk at the foot of the tower. There were two Imperial guards standing there, dimly visible by the light spilling from the tower's open door. Their pale faces were tipped up, looking at him. He wasn't sure whether to wave or not. One of them lifted his arm. A bright light shone up at Gurge, who shielded his eyes. A third, smaller, darker figure Gurge hadn't noticed before, moved toward the tower and entered it through the lit doorway. The torch beam switched off. The two guards took up positions on either side of the tower door. Steps sounded within the tower. Gurge sat on the stone bench again and waited.
Morat Gurge, good evening.
It was Nikosar. The dark, slightly stooped figure of the Emperor of Azad climbed up out of the tower.
Your Highness,
sit down, Gurge, the quiet voice said. Nikosar joined Gurge on the bench, his face like an indistinct white moon in front of him, lit only by the faint glow from the tower's stairwell. Gurge wondered if Nikosar could see him at all. The moon face turned away from him, looking toward the horizon-wide smudge of carmine.
There has been an attempt on my life, Gurge, the Emperor said quietly.
And, Gurge began, appalled.
Are you all right, Your Highness?
The moon face swung back.
I am unharmed.
The Apex held up one hand.
Please, no, Your Highness, now. We are alone. There is no breach of protocol. I wanted to explain to you personally why the castle is under martial law. The Imperial Guard have taken over all commands. I do not anticipate another attack, but one must take care.
But who would do this? Who would attack you? Nikosar looked to the north and the unseen hills.
We believe the culprits may have tried to escape along the viaduct to the reservoir lakes, so I've sent some guards there, too.
He turned slowly back to the man, and his voice was soft.
That's an interesting situation you've got me in, Morat Gurge.
Gurge sighed, looked at his feet.
Yes.
He glanced at the circle of white face in front of him.
I'm sorry. I mean that it's almost over.
He heard his own voice drop and could not bear to look at Nikosar.
Well, the Emperor said quietly, we shall see. I may have a surprise for you in the morning.
Gurge was startled. The hazily pale face in front of him was too vague for the expression to be read. But could Nikosar be serious? Surely the Apex could see his position was hopeless. Had he seen something Gurge hadn't? At once he started to worry. Had he been too certain? Nobody else had noticed anything, not even the ship. What if he was wrong? He wanted to see the board again, but even the imperfectly detailed image of it he still carried in his mind was accurate enough to show how their respective fortunes stood. Nikosar's defeat was implicit, but certain. He was sure there was no way out for the Emperor. The game must be over.
Tell me something, Gurge, Nikosar said evenly.
The white circle faced him again.
How long were you really learning the game for?
We told you the truth, 2 years. Intensively, but don't lie to me, Gurge. There's no point anymore.
Nikosar, I wouldn't lie to you. The moon face shook slowly.
Whatever you want.
The emperor was silent for a few moments.
You must be very proud of your culture.
He pronounced the last word with a distaste Gergi might have found comical if it hadn't been so obviously sincere.
Pride, he said. I don't know. I didn't make it. I just happened to be born into it.
Don't be simple, Gergi. I mean the pride of being part of something. The pride of representing your people. Are you going to tell me you don't feel that?
Some, perhaps, yes. But I'm not here as a champion, Nikasar. I'm not representing anything except myself. I'm here to play the game, that's all.
That's all, Nikasar repeated quietly. Well, I suppose we must say that you've played it well.
Gergi wished he could see the apex's face.
Had his voice quivered? Was that a tremor in his voice?
Thank you. But half the credit for this game is yours. More than half, because you said, I don't want your praise.
Nikosar lashed out with one hand, striking Gergi across the mouth. The heavy rings raked the man's cheek and lips. Gergi rocked back, stunned, dizzy with shock. Nikosar jumped up and went to the parapet, hands like claws on the dark stone. Gergi touched his blooded face. His hand was trembling.
You disgust me, Morat Gergi,
Nikosar said to the red glow in the west.
Your blind, insipid morality can't even account for your own success here, and you treat this battle game like some filthy dance. It is there to be fought and struggled against, and you've attempted to seduce it. You've perverted it, replaced our holy witnessing with your own foul pornography. You've soiled it. Male.
Gergi dabbed at the blood on his lips. He felt dizzy, head swimming.
That may be how you see it, Nikasar.
He swallowed some of the thick, salty blood.
I don't think you're being entirely fair to... Fair!
The Emperor shouted, coming to stand over Gergi, blocking the view of the distant fire.
Why does anything have to be fair? Is life fair?
He reached down and took Gergi by the hair, shaking his head.
Is it? Is it?
Gergi let the apex shake him. The Emperor let go of his hair after a moment, holding his hand as though he touched something dirty. Gergi cleared his throat.
No, life is not fair, not intrinsically.
The apex turned away in exasperation, clutching again at the curled stone top of the battlements.
It's something we can try to make it, though, Gergi continued. A goal we can aim for, you can choose to do so or not.
We have. I'm sorry you find us so repulsive for that.
Repulsive is barely adequate for what I feel for your precious culture, Gergi. I'm not sure I possess the words to explain to you what I feel for your culture. You know no glory, no pride, no worship. You have power. I've seen that. I know what you can do. But you're still impotent. You always will be. The meek, the pathetic, the frightened and cowed, they can only last so long, no matter how terrible and awesome the machines they crawl around within. In the end, you will fall. All your glittering machinery won't save you. The strong survive. That's what life teaches us, Gergi. That's what the game shows us. Struggle to prevail. Fight to prove worth. These are no hollow phrases. They are truth.
Gergi watched the pale hands grasping the dark stone. What could he say to this apex? Were they to argue metaphysics, here, now, with the imperfect tool of language, when they'd spent the last 10 days devising the most perfect image of their competing philosophies they were capable of expressing, probably in any form? What, anyway, was he to say? That intelligence could surpass and excel the blind force of evolution, with its emphasis on mutation, struggle and death? That conscious cooperation was more efficient than feral competition? That Azad could be so much more than a mere battle, if it was used to articulate, to communicate, to define? He'd done all that, said all that, and said it better than he ever could now.
You have not won, Gergi,
Nikosar said quietly, voice harsh, almost croaking.
Your kind will never win.
He turned back, looking down at him.
You poor, pathetic male. You play, but you don't understand any of this, do you?
Gergay heard what sounded like genuine pity in the Apex's voice.
I think you've already decided that I don't, he told Nikosar.
The Emperor laughed, turning back to the distant reflection of the continent-wide fire still below the horizon. The sound died in a sort of cough. He waved one hand at Gergay.
Your sort never will understand. You will only be used.
He shook his head in the darkness.
Go back to your room, Morat. I'll see you in the morning.
The moon face stared toward the horizon and the ruddy glare rubbed on the undersurface of the clouds.
The fire should be here by then.
Gergay waited a moment. It was as though he'd already gone. He felt dismissed, forgotten. Even Nikosar's last words had sounded as if they weren't really meant for Gergay at all. The man rose quietly and went back down through the dimly lit tower. The two guards stood impassively outside the door at the tower's foot. Gergay looked up to the top of the tower and saw Nikosar there on the battlements, flat, pale face looking out toward the approaching fire, white hands clutching at cold stone. The man watched for a few seconds, then turned and left, going down through the corridors and halls where the Imperial guards prowled, sending everybody to their rooms and locking the doors, watching all the stairs and elevators, and turning on all the lights so that the silent castle burned in the night, like some great stone ship on a darkly golden sea. Fleer Imsaho was flicking through the broadcast channels when Gergay got back to his room. It asked him what all the fuss was about in the castle. He told it.
Can't be that bad, the drone said with a wobble shrug. It looked back at the screen. They aren't playing martial music. No outgoing communications possible, though. What happened to your mouth?
I fell.
Mm-hmm.
Can we contact the ship?
Of course.
Tell it to power up. We might need it.
My, you're getting cautious. All right.
He went to bed, but lay awake, listening to the swelling roar of the wind. At the top of the high tower, the Apex watched the horizon for several hours, seemingly locked into the stone like a pale statue, or a small tree born of an errant seed. The wind from the east freshened, tugging at the stationary figure's dark clothes and howling round the dark, bright castle, tearing through the canopy of swaying cinderbuds, with a noise like the sea. The dawn came up. It lit the clouds first, then touched the edge of clear horizon and the east with gold. At the same time, in the black fastness of the west, where the edge of the land glowed red, a sudden glint of bright, burning orange-yellow appeared, to waver and hesitate and disappear, then return and brighten and spread. The figure on the tower drew back from that widening breach in the red-black sky and, glancing briefly behind him at the dawn, swayed uncertainly for a moment, as though caught between the rival currents of light flowing from each bright horizon. Two guards came to the room. They unlocked the door and told Gergay he and the machine were required in the prow hall. Gergay was dressed in his Azad robes. The guards told him it was the Emperor's pleasure that they abandon the statutory robes for this morning's play. Gergay looked at Fleer Imsaho and went to change. He put on a fresh shirt and the trews and light jacket he'd worn the previous night.
So, I'm getting a chance to spectate at last. What a treat,
Fleer Imsaho said, as they headed for the game hall. Gergay said nothing. Guards were escorting groups of people from various parts of the castle. Outside, beyond already shuttered doors and windows, the wind howled. Gergay hadn't felt like breakfast. The ship had been in contact that morning to congratulate him. It had finally seen. In fact, it thought there was a way out for Nikosar, but only to a draw, and no human brain could handle the play required. It had resumed its high-speed holding pattern, ready to come in the moment it sensed anything wrong. It watched through Fleer Imsaho's eyes. When they got to the castle's prow hall and the Board of Becoming, Nikosar was already there. The Apex wore the uniform of the Commander-in-Chief of the Imperial Guard, a severe, subtly menacing set of clothes complete with ceremonial sword. Gergay felt quite dowdy in his old jacket. The prow hall was almost full. People, escorted by the ubiquitous guards, were still filing into the tiered seats. Nikosar ignored Gergay. The Apex was talking to an officer of the guard.
Harmin,
Gergay said, going over to where the old Apex sat in the front row of seats.
his tiny, twisted body crumpled and hopeless between two burly guards. His face was shriveled and yellow. One of the guards put out his hand to stop Gergi coming any closer. He stood in front of the bench, squatting to look into the old rector's wrinkled face. "Harmin, can you hear me?" He thought again, absurdly, that the apex was dead. Then the small eyes flickered, and one opened, yellow-red and sticky with crystalline secretions. The shrunken-looking head moved a little.
"Gergi."
The eye closed. The head nodded. Gergi felt a hand on his sleeve, and he was led to his seat at the edge of the board. The Brauhall's balcony windows were closed, the panes rattling in their metal frames, but the fire shutters had not been lowered. Outside, beneath a leaden sky, the tall cinder buds shook in the gale, and the noise of the wind formed a bass background to the subdued conversations of the shuffling people still finding their places in the great hall. "Shouldn't they have put the shutters down?" Gerge asked the drone. He sat in the stool seat. Fleer Imseho floated, buzzing and crackling, behind him. The adjudicator and his helpers were checking the positions of the pieces.
"Yes," Fleer Imseho said. "The fire is less than 2 hours away. They can drop the shutters in the last few minutes if they have to, but they don't usually wait that long. I'd watch it, Gergi. Legally, the Emperor isn't allowed to call on the physical option at this stage, but there's something funny going on. I can sense it."
Gergi wanted to say something cutting about the drone's senses, but his stomach was churning, and he felt something was wrong too. He looked over at the bench where Harmin sat. The withered apex hadn't moved. His eyes were still closed.
"Something else," Fleer Imseho said.
"What?"
"There's some sort of extra gear up there on the ceiling."
Gergi glanced up without making it too obvious. The jumble of ECM and screening equipment looked much as it always had, but then he'd never inspected it very closely. "What sort of gear?" he asked.
"Gear that is worryingly opaque to my senses, which it shouldn't be. And that guard's colonel's wired with an optic remote mic."
"The officer talking to Nikosar?"
"Yes. Isn't that against the rules?"
"Supposed to be."
"Want to raise it with the adjudicator?"
The adjudicator was standing at the edge of the board between two burly guards. He looked frightened and grim. When his gaze fell on Gergi, it seemed to go straight through him. "I have a feeling," Gergi whispered, "it wouldn't do any good."
"Me too. Want me to get the ship to come in?"
"Can it get here before the fire?"
"Just."
Gergi didn't have to think too long. "Do it," he said.
"Signal sent. You remember the drill with the implant?"
"Vividly."
"Great," Fleer Imseho said sourly. "A high-speed displace from a hostile environment with some grey area effector gear around. Just what I need."
The hall was full. The doors were closed. The adjudicator glanced resentfully over at the guards colonel standing near Nikosar. The officer gave the briefest of nods. The adjudicator announced the recommencement of the game. Nikosar made a couple of inconsequential moves. Gergi couldn't see what the Emperor was aiming at. He must be trying to do something. But what? It didn't appear to have anything to do with winning the game. He tried to catch Nikosar's eye, but the apex refused to look at him. Gergi rubbed his cut lip and cheek. "I'm invisible," he thought. The cinderbuds swayed and shook in the storm outside. The leaves had spread to their maximum extent and, whipped by the gale, they looked indistinct and merged like one huge dull yellow organism, quivering and poised beyond the castle walls. Gergi could sense people in the hall moving restlessly, muttering to each other, glancing at the still unshuttered windows. The guards stayed at the hall's exits, guns ready. Nikosar made certain moves, placing element cards in particular positions. Gergi still couldn't see what the point of all this was. The noise of the storm beyond the shaking windows was enough to all but drown the voices of the people in the hall. The smell of the cinderbuds' volatile saps and juices pervaded the air, and some dry shreds of their leaves had found their way into the hall somehow, to soar and float and curl on currents of air inside the great hall. High in the stone-dark sky beyond the windows, a burning orange glow lit up the clouds. Gergi began to sweat. He walked over the board, made some replying moves, attempting to draw Nikosar out. He heard somebody in the observer's gallery crying out and then being quieted. The guards stood silently, watchfully, at the doors and around the board. The guard's colonel Nikosai had been talking to earlier stood near the emperor. As he went back to his stool seat, Gergay thought he saw tears on the officer's cheeks. Nikosai had been sitting. Now he stood, and taking four element cards, strode to the centre of the patterned terrain. Gergay wanted to shout out or leap up, something, anything, but he felt rooted, transfixed. The guards in the room had tensed. The emperor's hands were visibly shaking. The storm outside whipped the cinderbuds like something conscious and spiteful. A spear of orange leapt ponderously above the tops of the plants, writhed briefly against the wall of darkness behind it, then sank slowly out of sight.
"Oh, dear, holy shit," Fleer Imseho whispered. "That's only 5 minutes away."
"What?" Gergay glanced at the machine.
5 minutes, the drone said with a realistic gulp. "It ought to be nearly an hour off. It can't have got here this quick. They've started a new fire front."
Gergay closed his eyes. He felt the tiny lump under his paper-dry tongue. "The ship?" he said, opening his eyes again. The drone was silent for seconds.
"No chance," it said,
voice flat, resigned. Nikosar stooped. He placed a fire card on a water symbol already on the board, in a fold in the high terrain. The guard's colonel turned his head fractionally to one side, mouth moving as though blowing some speck of dust off his uniform's high collar. Nikosar stood up, looking around, appeared to listen for something, but heard only the howling noise of the storm.
"I just registered an infrasound pulse," Flea Imseho said. "That was an explosion, a click to north. The viaduct."
Gergay watched helplessly as Nikosar walked slowly to another position on the board and placed one card on another. Fire on air. The colonel talked into the mic near his shoulder again. The castle shook. A series of concussions shuddered through the hall. The pieces on the board juddered. People stood up, started shouting. The glass panes cracked in their frames, crashing to the flagstones, letting the shrieking voice of the burning gale into the hall in a hail of fluttering leaves. A line of flames burst over the tops of the trees, filling the base of the boiling black horizon with fire. The next fire card was placed on earth. The castle seemed to shift under Gergay. The wind tore in through the windows, rolling lighter pieces across the board like some absurd and unstoppable invasion. It whipped at the robes of the adjudicator and his officials. People were piling out of the galleries, falling over each other to get to the exits where the guards had drawn their guns. The sky was full of fire. Nikosar looked at Gergay as he placed the final fire card on the ghost element. Life.
"This is looking worse and worse, oh gree!"
Fleer Imseho said, voice breaking, screeching. Gergay whirled round to see the bulky machine trembling in midair, surrounded by a bright aura of green fire. The guards started shooting. The doors from the hall were thrown open, and the people piled through, but in the hall the guards were suddenly all over the board itself, firing up into the galleries and benches, blasting laser fire among the escaping crowds, felling the screaming, struggling apices, females and males, in a storm of flickering light and shattering detonations. Fleer Imseho screamed. Its casing glowed dull red and started to smoke. Gergay watched, transfixed. Nikosar stood near the centre of the boards, surrounded by his guards, smiling at Gergay. The fire raged above the cinderbuds. The hall emptied as a last few wounded people staggered through the doors. Fleer Imseho hung in the air. It glowed orange, yellow, white. It started to rise, dripping blobs of molten material onto the board as it went, enveloped suddenly in flames and smoke. Suddenly, it accelerated across the hall as if pulled by some huge, invisible hand. It slammed into a far wall and exploded in a blinding flash and a blast that almost blew Gergay off his stool seat. The guards around the emperor left the board and climbed over the benches and galleries, killing the wounded. They ignored Gergay. The sound of firing echoed through the doors leading to the rest of the castle, where the dead lay in their bright clothes like some obscene carpet. Nikosar strolled slowly over to Gergay, stopping to tap a few Azad pieces out of his way with his boots as he advanced. He stamped on a little guttering pool of fire left from the molten debris Fleer Imseho had trailed behind it. He drew his sword almost casually. Gergay clutched the arms of the seat. The inferno shrieked in the skies outside. Leaves swirled through the hall like dry, endless rain. Nikosar stopped in front of Gergay. The emperor was smiling, He shouted above the gale.
Surprised?
Gerge could hardly speak.
What have you done?
Why? He croaked. Nikusar shrugged.
Made the game real, Gerge.
He looked around the hall, surveying the carnage. They were alone now. The guards were spreading through the rest of the castle, killing. The fallen were everywhere, scattered over the floor and the galleries, draped over benches, crumpled in corners, spread like X's on the flagstones, their robes spotted with the dark burn holes of laser burns. Smoke rose from the splintered woodwork and smouldering clothes. A sweet sick smell of burned flesh filled the hall. Nikusar weighed the heavy double-edged sword in his gloved hand, smiling sadly at it. Gerge felt his bowels ache and his hands shake. There was a strange metallic taste in his mouth, and at first he thought it was the implant, rejecting, surfacing, for some reason reappearing, but then he knew that it wasn't, and realized for the first time in his life that fear really did have a taste. Nikusar gave an inaudible sigh, drew himself up in front of Gerge so that he seemed to fill the view in front of the man, and brought the sword slowly toward Gerge.
Drone,
he thought, but it was just a sooty scar on the far wall.
Ship?
But the implant under his tongue lay silent, and the limiting factor was still light years away. The tip of the sword was a few centimeters from Gerge's belly. It started to rise, passing slowly over Gerge's chest toward his neck. Nikusar opened his mouth as though he was about to say something, but then he shook his head, as though in exasperation, and lunged forward. Gerge kicked out, slamming both feet into the Emperor's belly. Nikusar doubled up. Gerge was thrown backward off the seat. The sword hissed over his head. Gerge kept on rolling as the stool seat crashed to the ground. He jumped to his feet. Nikusar was half doubled up, but still clutched the sword. He staggered toward the man, hacking the sword about him as though it had invisible enemies between them. Gerge ran, to the side at first, then across the board, heading for the hall doors. Behind him, outside the windows, the fire above the thrashing cinderbuds obliterated the black clouds of smoke. The heat was something physical, a pressure on the skin and eyes. One of Gerge's feet came down on a game piece, rolled across the board by the gale. He slipped and fell. Nikusar stumbled after him. The screening equipment whined, then hummed. Smoke gouted from it. Blue lightning played furiously around the hanging machinery. Nikusar didn't notice. He plunged forward at Gerge, who pushed himself away. The sword crashed into the board centimeters from the man's head. Gerge picked himself up and leapt over a raised section of board. Nikusar came tearing and trampling after him. The screening gear exploded. It crashed from the ceiling to the board in a shower of sparks and smashed into the center of the multicolored terrain a few meters in front of Gerge, who was forced to stop and turn. He faced Nikusar. Something white blurred through the air. Nikusar raised the sword over his head. The blade snapped, clipped off by a flickering yellow-green field. Nikusar felt the weight of the sword change and looked up in disbelief. The blade dangled uselessly in midair, suspended from the little white disc that was Fleer Imseho. Ha ha ha! It boomed above the noise of the screaming wind. Nikusar threw the sword handle at Gerge. A green-yellow field caught it, propelled it back at Nikusar. The Emperor ducked. He staggered across the board in a storm of smoke and swirling leaves. The cinderbuds thrashed. Flashes of white and yellow burst from between their trunks as the wall of flames above them beat toward the castle.
Gerge,
Fleer Imseho said, suddenly in front of his face. Crouch down and curl up now! Gerge did as he was told, getting down on his haunches, arms wrapped around his shins. The drone floated above him, and Gerge saw the haze of a field all around him. The wall of cinderbuds was breaking, the streaks and bursts of flame clawing through from behind them, shaking them, tearing them. The heat seemed to shrivel his face on the bones of his skull. A figure appeared against the flames. It was Nikusar, holding one of the big laser pistols the guards had been armed with. He stood just within and to the side of the windows, holding the gun in both hands and sighting carefully at Gerge. Gerge looked at the black muzzle of the gun, into the thumb-wide barrel. Then his gaze moved up to Nikusar's face as the apex pulled the trigger. Then he was looking at himself. He stared into his own distorted face just long enough to see that Jernal Murat Gerge, at the very instant that might have been his death, looked only rather surprised and not a little stupid. Then the mirror field disappeared, and he was looking at Nikosar again. The apex stood in exactly the same place, swaying slightly now. There was something wrong, though. Something had changed. It was very obvious, but Gurge couldn't see what it was. The Emperor went back on his heels, eyes staring blankly up at the smoke-stained ceiling where the screening gear had fallen from. Then the furnace gust from the windows caught him, and he tipped slowly forward again, tipping toward the board, the weight of the hand cannon in his gloved hands unbalancing him. Gurge saw it then, the neat, slightly smoking black hole about wide enough to fit a thumb into, in the center of the apex's forehead. Nikosar's body hit the board with a crash, scattering pieces. The fire broke through. The Cinderbud Dam gave way before the flames and was replaced by a vast wave of blinding light and a blast of heat like a hammer blow. Then the field around Gurge went dark, and the room and all the fire went dim. And far away at the back of his head, there was a strange buzzing noise, and he felt drained and empty and exhausted. After that, everything went away from him, and there was only darkness. Gurge opened his eyes. He was lying on a balcony, under a jutting overhang of stone. The area around him had been swept clear, but everywhere else there was a centimeter-thick covering of dark grey ash. It was dull. The stones beneath him were warm. The air was cool and smoky. He felt all right. No drowsiness, no sore head. He sat up. Something fell from his chest and rolled across the swept stones, falling into the grey dust. He picked it up. It was the orbital bracelet, bright and undamaged, and still keeping its own microscopic day-night cycle. He put it into his jacket pocket. He checked his hair, his eyebrows, his jacket. Nothing singed at all. The sky was dark grey, black at the horizon. Away to one side there was a small, vaguely purple disk in the sky, which he realized was the sun. He stood up. The grey ash was being covered up with inky soot, falling from the dark overcast like negative snow. He walked across the heat-warped, flaking flagstones toward the edge of the balcony. The parapet had fallen away here. He kept back from the very edge. The landscape had changed. Instead of the golden-yellow wall of cinder buds crowding the view beyond the curtain wall, there was just earth, black and brown and baked-looking, covered in great cracks and fissures the thin grey ash and the soot rain had not yet filled. The barren waste stretched to the distant horizon. Faint wisps of smoke still climbed from fissures in the ground, climbing like the ghosts of trees until the wind took them. The curtain wall was blackened and scorched and breached in places. The castle itself looked battered, as though after a long siege. Towers had collapsed, and many of the apartments, office buildings and extra halls had fallen in on themselves, their flame-scarred windows showing only emptiness behind. Columns of smoke rose lazily like sinuous flagpoles to the summit of the crumbling fortress, where the wind caught them and made them penance. Gurge walked round the balcony, through the soft black snow of soot, to the prow hall windows. His feet made no noise. The specks of soot made him sneeze and his eyes itched. He entered the hall. The stones still held their dry heat. It was like walking into a vast, dark oven. Inside the great game room, among the dim shambles of twisted girders and fallen stonework, the board lay, warped and buckled and torn, its rainbow of colours reduced to greys and blacks, its carefully balanced topography of high ground and low made a nonsense of by the random heavings and saggings induced by the fire. Buckled, annealed girders and holes in the floor and walls marked where the observation galleries had been. The screening gear, which had fallen from the ceiling of the hall, lay half-melted and congealed in the centre of the Azad board, like some blistered travesty of a mountain. He turned to look at the window where Nikosar had stood, and walked over the creaking surface of the ruined board. He crouched down, grunting as his knees sent stabs of pain through him. He put his hand out to where an eddy in the firestorm had collected a little conical pile of dust in the angle of an internal buttress, right at the edge of the game board, near where a fused, L-shaped lump of blackened metal might have been the remains of a gun. The grey-white ash was soft and warm, and mixed in with it he found a small, C-shaped piece of metal. The half-melted ring still contained the setting for a jewel, like a tiny rough crater on its rim, but the stone was gone. He looked at the ring for a while, blowing the ash off it and turning it over and over in his hands. After a while, he put the ring back into the pile of dust. He hesitated, then he took the orbital bracelet out of his jacket pocket and added it to the shallow grey cone, pulled the two poison warning rings off his fingers and put them there too. He scooped a handful of the warm ash into one palm, gazing at it thoughtfully.
Chernow Gurge, good morning.
He turned and rose, quickly stuffing his hand into his jacket pocket as though ashamed of something. The little white body of Fleer Imseho floated in through the window, very tiny and clean and exact in that shattered, melted place. A tiny grey thing, the size of a baby's finger, floated up to the drone from the ground near Gurge's feet. A hatch opened in Fleer Imseho's immaculate body. The micro-missile entered the drone. A section of the machine's body revolved, then was still.
Hello, Gurge said, walking over to it.
He looked round the ruined hall, then back at the drone.
I hope you're going to tell me what happened.
Sit down, Gurge. I'll tell you.
He sat on a block of stone fallen from above the windows. He looked dubiously upward at where it must have fallen from.
Don't worry, Fleer Imseho said. You're safe. I checked the roof.
Gurge rested his hands on his knees.
So? He said.
First things first, Fleer Imseho said. Allow me to introduce myself properly. My name is Sprant Fleer Imseho Wuhandrahan Zeto Trabiti, and I am not a library drone.
Gurge nodded. He recognized some of the nomenclature Chark Hub had been so impressed with long ago. He didn't say anything.
If I had been a library drone, you'd be dead. Even if you'd escaped Nikosar, you'd have been incinerated a few minutes later.
I appreciate that, Gurge said. Thank you.
His voice sounded flat, wrung out, and not especially grateful.
I thought they'd got you.
Killed you.
Damn nearly did, the drone said. That firework display was for real. Nikosar must have got his hands on some Equivtech effector gear, which means, or meant, the Empire has had some sort of contact with another advanced civilization. I've scanned what's left of the equipment. Could be Hamamda stuff. Anyway, the ship will load it for further analysis.
Where is the ship? I thought we'd be on it, not still down here.
It came barreling through half an hour after the fire hit. Could have snapped us both off, but I reckoned we were safer staying where we were. I had no trouble insulating you from the fire, and keeping you under with my effector was easy enough, too. The ship popped us a couple of spare drones and kept on going, braking and turning. It's on its way back now. Should be overhead in 5 minutes. We can go safely back up in the module. Like I said, displacement can be risky.
Gurge gave a sort of half-laugh through his nose. He looked around the dim hall again.
I'm still waiting, he told the machine.
The Imperial Guards went crazy on Nikosar's orders. They blew up the aqueduct, cisterns and shelters, and killed everybody they could find. They tried to take over the Invincible from the Navy, too. In the resulting onboard firefight, the ship crashed, came down somewhere in the Northern Ocean. Biggish splash. Tsunami swept away rather a lot of mature cinderbuts, but I dare say the fire will cope. There was no attempt to kill Nikosar the other night. That was just a ruse, to get the whole castle and the game under the control of guards who do anything the Emperor told them.
Why, though? Gurge said tiredly, kicking at a blister of board metal. Why did Nikosar order them to do all that?
He told them it was the only way to defeat the culture and save him. They didn't know he was doomed, too. They thought he had some way of saving himself. Maybe they'd have done it regardless, even knowing that. They were very highly trained. Anyway, they obeyed their orders.
The machine made a chuckling noise.
Most of them, anyway. A few left the shelter they were supposed to blow up intact, and got some people into it with them. So, you're not unique. There are some other survivors. Mostly servants. Nikosar made sure all the important people were in here. The ship's drones are with the survivors. We're keeping them locked up until you're safely away. They'll have enough rations to last until they're rescued.
Go on.
You sure you can handle all this stuff right now?
Just tell me why, Gurge said, sighing.
You've been used, Yurna Gurge, the drone said matter-of-factly.
The truth is, you were playing for the culture, and Nikosar was playing for the Empire. I personally told the Emperor the night before the start of the last match that you really were our champion. If you won, we were coming in. We'd smash the Empire and impose our own order. If he won, we'd keep out for as long as he was Emperor, and for the next 10 great years anyway. That's why Nikosar did all he did. He wasn't just a sore loser. He'd lost his empire. He had nothing else to live for, so why not go in a blaze of glory?
Was all that true? Gurge asked. Would we really have taken over?
Gurge, Flea Imsaho said, I have no idea. Not in my brief. No need to know. It doesn't matter. He believed it was true.
Slightly unfair pressure, Gurge said, smiling without any humor at the machine. Telling somebody they're playing for such high stakes just the night before the game.
Gamespersonship.
So why didn't he tell me what we were playing for?
Guess.
The bet would have been off, and we came in all guns blazing anyway.
Correct.
Gurge shook his head, brushed a little soot off one jacket sleeve, smudging it. You really thought I'd win? He asked the drone. Against Nikosar. You thought that even before I got here.
Before you left Chark, Gurge. As soon as you showed any interest in leaving. SC's been looking for somebody like you for quite a while. The Empire's been ripe to fall for decades. It needed a big push. But it could always go. Coming in all guns blazing, as you put it, is almost never the right approach. Azad, the game itself, had to be discredited. It was what had held the Empire together all these years. The linchpin. But that made it the most vulnerable point, too.
The drone made a show of looking around at the mangled debris of the hall.
Everything worked out a little more dramatically than we'd expected, I must admit. But it looks like all the analyses of your abilities and Nikosar's weaknesses were just about right.
My respect for those great minds which use the likes of you and me like game pieces increases all the time. Those are very smart machines. They knew I'd win, Gurge asked disconsolately, chin in hand.
You can't know something like that, Gurge. But they must have thought you stood a good chance. I had some of it explained to me in my briefing. They thought you were just about the best game player in the culture.
And if you got interested and involved, then there wasn't much any Azad player could do to stop you, no matter how long they'd spent playing the game.
You've spent all your life learning games. There can't be a rule, move, concept, or idea in Azad you haven't encountered 10 times before in other games. It just brought them all together. These guys never stood a chance. All you needed was somebody to keep an eye on you and give you the occasional nudge in the right direction at the appropriate times.
The drone dipped briefly, a little bow.
Yours truly.
All my life, Gurge said quietly, looking past the drone to the dull, dead landscape outside the tall windows.
60 years. And how long has the culture known about the Empire?
About... Ah, you're thinking we shaped you somehow?
Not so.
If we did that sort of thing, we wouldn't need outsider mercenaries like Shehobaham Za to do the really dirty work.
Za, Gurge said. Not his real name, not Culture-born at all. Yes, he's what you'd call a mercenary. Just as well, too, or the secret police would have shot you outside that tent. Remember timid little me nipping out of the way? I just shot one of your assailants with my crew, on high X-ray so it wouldn't register on the cameras. Za broke the neck of another one. He'd heard there might be some trouble. He'll probably be leading a guerrilla army on Ea in a couple of days from now, I imagine. The drone gave a little wobble in the air.
Let's see. What else can I tell you?
Oh, yes. The limiting factor isn't as innocent as it looks either. While we were on the little rascal, we did take out the old effectors, but only so we could put in new ones. Just two, in 2 of the 3 nose blisters. We put the empty one on clear and hollows of empty blisters in the other two.
But I was in all 3, Gurge protested.
No, you were in the same one 3 times. The ship just rotated the corridor's housing, fiddled with the AG and had a couple of drones change things around a bit while you were going from one to the other. Or, rather, down one corridor, up another, and back to the same blister. All for nothing, mind you. But if we had needed some heavy weaponry, it would have been there. It's forward planning that makes one feel safe, don't you think?
Oh, yes, Gurge said, sighing. He got to his feet and went back out onto the balcony, where the black soot snow fell steadily and quietly.
Talking about the limiting factor, Fleer Imsaho said cheerily, the old reprobate is overhead now. Module's on its way. We'll have you aboard in a minute or two. You can have a nice wash and change out of those dirty clothes. Are you ready to leave?
Gurge looked down at his feet, scuffed some of the soot and ash across the flagstones.
What is there to pack?
Not a lot, indeed. I was too busy keeping you from baking to go in search of your belongings. Anyway, the only thing you seem to be fond of is that tatty old jacket. Did you get that bracelet thing? I left it on your chest when I went exploring.
Yes, thanks, Gurge said, gazing out at the flat black desolation stretching to the dark horizon. He looked up. The module burst through the deep brown overcast, trailing strands of vapor.
Thanks, Gurge said again, as the module swooped, dropping almost to ground level, then racing across the scorched desert toward the castle, drawing a plume of ash and soot off the ground in its wake as it slowed and started to turn, and the noise of its supersonic plummet cracked round the forlorn fortress like too late thunder.
Thanks for everything.
The craft swung its rear toward the castle, floating up until it was level with the edge of the balcony parapet. Its rear door opened, made a flat ramp. The man walked across the balcony, stepped up onto the parapet, and into the cool interior of the machine. The drone followed, and the door closed. The module blasted suddenly away, sucking a great swirling fountain of ash and soot after it as it climbed, flashing through the dark clouds above the castle like some solid lightning bolt, while its thunder broke across the plain and the castle and the low hills behind. Ash settled again. The soot continued its soft and gentle fall. The module returned a few minutes later to pick up the ship's drones and the remains of the alien effector equipment, then left the castle for the last time and rose again to its waiting ship. A little while later, the small band of dazed survivors, released by the two ship's drones and mostly servants, soldiers, concubines, and clerks, stumbled into the daytime night and the soot-like snow to take stock of their temporary exile in the once great fortress and claim their vanished land. Part 4. The Past Pawn. Lazy matching, dull siding, the ship went slowly through one end of a tensor field 3 million kilometers long, over a wall of monocrystal, then started to float down through the gradually thickening atmosphere of the plate. From 500 kilometers up, the two slabs of land and sea, the one beyond them of raw rock under deep cloud, and the one beyond that of still-forming land, showed clear in the night air. Beyond its crystal wall, the farthest plate was very new. Dark and void to normal sight, the ship could see on it the illuminating radars of the landscaping machines as they moved their cargoes of rock in from space. Even as the vessel watched, a huge asteroid was detonated in the darkness, producing a slow fountain of red glowing molten rock which fell slowly to the new surface or was caught and held, molded in the vacuum before it was allowed to settle. The plate beside it was dark too, and near the bottom of its squared-off funnel a blanket of clouds covered it completely as its rawness was weathered. The other two plates were much older and twinkled with lights. Chark was at aphelion. Givant and Osmolon were white on black, islands of snow on dark seas. The old warship slowly submerged itself in the atmosphere, floating down the blade-flat slope of the plate wall to where the real air began, then set out of the ocean for the land. A sea ship, a liner on that ocean and bright with lights, blasted its horns and set off fireworks as the limiting factor went over, a kilometer up. The ship saluted too, using its effectors to produce artificial auroras, roaring, shifting folds of light in the clear, still air above it. Then the two ships sailed on into the night. It had been an uneventful journey back. The man, Gurge, had wanted to be stored at once, saying he didn't want to be awake during the journey back. He wanted sleep, rest, a period of oblivion. The ship had insisted he think it over first, even though it had the equipment ready. After 10 days, it had relented, and the man, who'd become increasingly morose during that time, went thankfully into a dreamless, low-metabolism sleep. He hadn't played a single game of any description during those 10 days, hardly said a word, couldn't even bother to get dressed, and spent most of his time just sitting staring at walls. The drone had agreed that putting him to sleep for the journey was probably the kindest thing they could do.
They'd crossed the lesser cloud and met with the range-class GSV So Much for Subtlety, which was heading back for the main galaxy. The inward journey had taken longer than the outward, but there'd be no hurry. The ship had left the GSV near the higher reaches of a galactic limb and cut down and across, past stars, dust fields and nebulae, where the hydrogen migrated and the suns formed, and in the ship's domain of unreal space, the holes were pillars of energy, from fabric to grid. It had woken the man up slowly, 2 days out from his home. He still sat and stared at the walls. He didn't play any games, catch up on any news, or even deal with his mail. At his request, it hadn't signalled ahead to any of his friends, just sent one permission-to-approach burst to Chark Hub. It dropped a few hundred metres and followed the line of the fjord, slipping silently between the snow-covered mountains, its sleek hull reflecting a little blue-grey light as it floated over the dark, still water. A few people on yachts or in nearby houses saw the big craft as it cruised quietly by and watched it manoeuvre its bulk delicately between bank and bank, water and patchy cloud. Ikro was dark and unlit, caught in the star shadow of the 350-metre length of silent craft above it. Gergay took a last look round the cabin he'd been sleeping in, fitfully, for the last couple of ship nights, then walked slowly down the corridor to the module blister. Fleer Imseho followed him with one small bag, wishing the man would change out of that horrible jacket. It saw him into the module and came down with him. The lawn in front of the dark house was pure white and untouched. The module lowered to within a centimetre of it, then opened its rear door. Gergay stepped out and down. The air was fragrant and sharp, a tangible clarity. His feet made cramping, creaking noises in the snow. He turned back to the lit interior of the module. Fleer Imseho gave him his bag. He looked at the small machine. "Goodbye," he said.
"Goodbye, Jerna Gergay. I don't expect we shall ever meet again."
"I suppose not." He stepped back as the door started to swing closed and the craft began to rise very slowly. Then he took a couple of quick steps backward until he could just see the drone over the rising lip of the door and shouted, "One thing!" When Nikosov fired that gun and the ray came off the mirror field and hit him, was that coincidence? Or did you aim it? He thought it wasn't going to answer him. But just before the door closed and the wedge of light thrown over it disappeared with the rising craft, he heard the drone say,
"I am not going to tell you."
He stood and watched the module float back to the waiting ship. It was taken inside. The blister closed, and the limiting factor went black. Its hull, a perfect shadow, darker than the night. A pattern of lights came on along its length, spelling "Farewell" in Moraine. Then it started to move, rising noiselessly upward. Gergay watched it until the still-shone lights were just a set of moving stars and fast receding in a sky of ghostly clouds. Then he looked down at the faintly blue-grey snow. When he looked up again, the ship had gone. He stood for a while as though waiting. After a time, he turned and tramped across the white lawn to the house. He went in through the windows. The house was warm, and he shivered suddenly in his cool clothes for a second. Then suddenly, the lights went on.
"Boo!"
Yay Maristanu leapt out from behind a couch by the fire. Chamlis Amalkne appeared from the kitchen with a tray.
"Hello, Jerna. I hope you don't mind."
Gergay's pale, pinched face broke into a smile. He put his bag down and looked at them both. Yay, fresh-faced and grinning, leaping over the couch, and Chamlis, fields orange-red, setting the tray down on the table before the banked fire. Yay thudded into him, arms round him, hugging him, laughing. She drew back.
"Gergay!"
Yay. "Hello," he said, dropping his bag and hugging her.
"How are you?" she asked him, squeezing him. "Are you all right? We annoyed Hub until it told us you were definitely coming. But you've been asleep all this time, haven't you? You didn't even read my letters."
Gergay looked away. "No, I've got them, but I haven't..." He shook his head, looked down. "I'm sorry."
"Never mind."
Yay patted his shoulder. She kept one arm round him and took him to the couch. He sat, looking at them both. Chamlis broke up the damp sawdust banking on the fire, releasing the flames beneath. Yay spread her arms, showing off short skirt and waistcoat.
"Changed, haven't I?"
Gergay nodded. Yay looked as well and handsome as ever, and androgynous. "Just changing back," she said. "Another few months, and I'll be back where I started."
Oh, Gergay, you should have seen me as a man. I was dashing.
He was unbearable, Chamlis said, pouring some mulled wine from a pot-bellied jug.
Yay threw herself onto the couch beside Gergay, hugging him again and making a growling noise in her throat. Chamlis handed them gently steaming goblets of wine. Gergay drank gratefully.
"I didn't expect to see you," he told Ye. "I thought you'd gone away."
"I went away," Ye nodded, gulping her wine. "I came back. Last summer. Chark's getting another plate pair. I put in some plans. And now I'm team coordinator for Farside."
"Congratulations, floating islands."
Ye looked blank for a second, then laughed into her goblet.
"No floating islands, Gergay."
"Plenty of volcanoes, though," Chamlis said sniffily, sucking a thread of wine from a thimble-sized container.
"Perhaps one little one," Ye nodded.
Her hair was longer than he remembered, blue-black, still as curly. She punched him gently on the shoulder.
"It's good to see you again, Gergay."
He squeezed her hand, looked at Chamlis.
"Good to be back," he said,
then fell silent, staring at the burning logs in the fireplace.
"We're all glad you're back, Gergay," Chamlis said after a while. "But if you don't mind my saying so, you don't look too good. We heard you were in storage for the last couple of years, but there's something else. What happened out there? We've heard all sorts of reports. Do you want to talk about it?"
Gergay hesitated, gazing at the leaping flames consuming the jumbled logs in the fire. He put his glass down and started to explain. He told them all that happened, from the first few days aboard the Limiting Factor to the last few days, again on the ship, as it powered out of the disintegrating empire of Azad. Chamlis was quiet, and its fields changed slowly through many colours. Ye grew slowly more concerned-looking. She shook her head frequently, gasped several times, and looked ill twice. In between, she kept the fire stocked with logs. Gergay sipped his lukewarm wine.
"So? I slept all the way back until 2 days out. And now it all seems... I don't know. Deep frozen. Not fresh, but not decayed yet. Not gone."
He swilled the wine around in his goblet. His shoulders shook with a half-hearted laugh.
"Oh, well." He drained his glass.
Chamlis lifted the jug from the ashes at the front of the fire and refilled Gergay's goblet with the hot wine.
"Jana, I can't tell you how sorry I am. This was all my fault. If I hadn't..."
"No," Gergay said. "Not your fault. I got myself into it. You did warn me. Don't ever say that. Don't ever think it was anybody's responsibility but mine." He got up suddenly and walked to the fjordside windows, looking down the slope of snow-covered lawn to the trees and the black water, and over it to the mountains and the scattered lights of the houses on the far shore. "You know," he said, as though talking to his own reflection in the glass, "I asked the ship yesterday exactly what they did do about the Empire in the end, how they went in to sort it out. It said they didn't even bother. Fell apart all on its own." He thought of Harmin, and Mononine, and Inklate, and Atsin, and Bamoya, and Zaa, and Olos, and Kroo, and the girl whose name he'd forgotten. He shook his head at his image in the glass. "Anyway, it's over." He turned back to Ye and Chamlis in the warm room. "What's the gossip here?" So they told him about Haflis's twins, both talking now, and Baruelal leaving to go GSVing for a few years, and Altshap, breaker of not a few young hearts, being more or less acclaimed, embarrassed, forced into Baruelal's old post, and Ye fathering a child a year back. He'd get to meet mother and child next year, probably, when they came for an extended visit. And one of Shuro's pals being killed in a combat game 2 years back, and Ren Miglan becoming a man, and Chamlis still hard at work on the reference text for its pet planet, and Tron's festival the year before last ending in disaster and chaos after some fireworks blew up in the lake and swamped half the cliffside terraces. 2 people dead, brains splattered over lumps of stonework, hundreds injured. Last year's hadn't been half so exciting. Gergay was listening to all this as he wandered round the room, reacquainting himself with it. Nothing much seemed to have changed.
"What a lot I've missed," he began,
then noticed the little wooden plaque on the wall, and the object mounted on it. He reached out, touched it, took it down from the wall.
"Ah," Chamness said, making what was almost a coughing noise. "I hope you don't mind. I mean, I hope you don't think that's too irreverent or tasteless. I just thought..."
Gurge smiled sadly, touching the lifeless surfaces of the body that had once been Morhen Skell. He turned back to Ye and Chamless, walking over to the old drone. "Not at all. But I don't want it. Do you?"
"Yes, please."
Gurge presented the heavy little trophy to Chamless, who went red with pleasure.
"You vindictive old horror," Ye snorted. "This means a great deal to me," Chamless said primly, holding the plaque close to its casing.
Gurge put his glass back on the tray. A log collapsed in the fire, showering sparks up. Gurge crouched and poked at the remaining logs. He yawned. Ye and the drone exchanged looks. Then Ye reached out and tapped Gurge with one foot.
"Come on, Jernau. You're tired. Chamless has to head back home and make sure its new fishes haven't eaten each other. Is it all right if I stay here?"
Gurge looked, surprised at her smiling face, and nodded. When Chamless left, Ye put her head on Gurge's shoulder and said she'd missed him a lot, and 5 years was a long time, and he looked a lot more cuddleable than when he'd gone away, and if he wanted, if he wasn't too tired. She used her mouth, and on her forming body, Gurge traced slow movements, rediscovering sensations he'd almost forgotten. Stroking her gold-dark skin, caressing the odd, almost comic unbuddings of her now concaving genitals, making her laugh, laughing with her, and, in the long moment of climax, with her then, too, still one, their every tactile cell surging to a single pulse, as though alight. Still he didn't sleep, and in the night got up out of the tousled bed. He went to the windows and opened them. The cold night air spilled in. He shivered, pulled on the True's jacket and shoes. Ye moved and made a small noise. He closed the windows and went back to the bed, crouching down in the darkness beside her. He pulled the covers over her exposed back and shoulder, and moved his hand very gently through her curls. She snored once and stirred, then breathed quietly on. He crossed to the windows and went quickly outside, closing them silently behind him. He stood on the snow-covered balcony, gazing at the dark trees descending in uneven rows to the glittering black fjord. The mountains on the far side shone faintly, and above them, in the crisp night, dim areas of light moved on the darkness, occluding starfields and the far side plates. The clouds drifted slowly, and down at Ikro there was no wind. Gurge looked up and saw among the clouds, the clouds, their ancient light hardly wavering in the cold, calm air. He watched his breath go out before him like a damp smoke between him and those distant stars, and shoved his chilled hands into the jacket pockets for warmth. One touched something softer than the snow, and he brought it out. A little dust. He looked up from it, at the stars again, and the view was warped and distorted by something in his eyes, which at first he thought was rain.
"No, not quite the end. There's still me. I know I've been naughty not revealing my identity, but then maybe you guessed, and who am I to deprive you of the satisfaction of working it out for yourself? Who am I indeed? Yes, I was there, all the time. Well, more or less all the time. I watched, I listened, I thought and sensed and waited, and did as I was told, or asked to maintain the proprieties. I was there all right, in person, or in the shape of one of my representatives, my little spies. To be honest, I don't know whether I'd have liked old Gurge to have found out the truth or not. Still undecided on that one, I must confess. We left it to chance in the end. For example, just supposing Chark-Hub had told our hero the exact shape of the cavity in the husk that had been Morhen Skell, or Gurge had somehow opened that lifeless casing and seen for himself. Would he have thought that little disc-shaped hole a mere coincidence? Or would he have started to suspect? We'll never know. If you're reading this, he's long dead, had his appointment with the displacement drone and been zapped to the very livid heart of the system, corpse blasted to plasma in the vast erupting core of Chark's sun,
his sundered atoms rising and falling in the raging fluid thermals of the mighty star, each pulverized particle migrating over the millennia to that planet-swallowing surface of blinding, storm-swept fire to boil off there, and so add their own little parcels of meaningless illumination to the encompassing night. Ah, well, getting a bit flowery there. Still, an old drone should be allowed such indulgences now and again, don't you think? Let me recapitulate. This is a true story. I was there. When I wasn't, and when I didn't know exactly what was going on, inside Gurgi's mind, for example, I admit that I have not hesitated to make it up. But it's still a true story. Would I lie to you? As ever, Sprant Fleer Imsaho Wuhandrihen Zeto Trabiti, Moran Skell. This has been an Ashet Digital production of The Player of Games, written by Ian M. Banks and read by Peter Kenny. Produced and directed by Talking Issues. Text copyright, Ian Banks, 1988. Production copyright, Ashet Digital, 2010.
This audio program is presented by Audible.com. Audible, audio that speaks to you wherever you are.